So you want to do a goal setting episode?
That's what we were saying. I said I didn't want to do a goal setting episode.
I have goals. I'll set goals.
What goals?
I'm going to take a nap. That's my goal.
Your goal is to go back to sleep.
Yeah. I'm having a really weird sleep day.
What's going on? Yeah, you woke up and then went back to sleep. That yeah. was very odd.
Well, I've been diligently working on this writing project and I've been getting up at 5:30, which is like a newer schedule for me. Usually I'm up at 6:30. So I did my writing and got some good stuff done. And then I was just so tired. So I went back to sleep from like 7 to 8.
That's a kind of a good way to do it, I think.
Well, normally that's my workout time, but I slept instead of working out.
Yeah. But you got stuff done, you know, like, because by the time it was 7:40 or 7:20, you already had a bunch of stuff done. So it's not a bad way to do it, I think.
We plan to talk through the issues faced by startup founders and the people close to them.
That overused phrase, work-life balance.
It is an amazingly focusing time.
This is what we do, you know, aside from our families, this is our whole work life.
I am also known as Dr. Wine.
You know, this woman is non-traditional.
A little more zen in the startup life.
Zen founder. Those days were a mental struggle.
I have been stressed in the past, and I know that I will be in the future.
A founder and his or her significant other would both get value from the episode.
So since my sole ambition in life right now is to go back to sleep, what else are we going to talk about? Because I don't think that our listeners really will be inspired by that as a goal.
Yeah, as admirable as it is. We want to talk about like building a healthy working culture or healthy, it's almost like healthy working relationships. And so you could think of this originally, I think you'd thrown out like building a healthy company culture. And that actually sounds a little more grandiose than I think we want to get to. I was really thinking of, you know, even if you're a team of two, your co-founders, or you have your first hire, this is an important subject to talk about. It's like working relationships, work style, and how to do that well, starting from the very first person that you're working with. And we know most listeners of the podcast are not managing massive teams, big companies of a few hundred people. But this stuff is important, whether you're kind of managing one person or whether you're managing 10 or 15. And that's really what we want to talk about today. I think I've seen a lot in my career of where this has done really well, where this is not done well. And I've tried to borrow and kind of be more similar to the working relationships that I've enjoyed. And you as well, you've lived through them yourself. And then you've dealt with a lot of clients now who are seeing both sides of this coin.
Yeah, I think that's really true. I'm also remembering when we did our co-founder series, when we talked a lot about co-founder relationships and realizing that that kind of relationship, your work relationships, whether it's with your co-founder or your contractors, can really make or break your quality of life at work, as well as I think the functionality of your business. So it seems like a good thing for us to jump into. This has come up a lot for me lately in the consulting practice, where people are talking about relationships within their team that are not healthy and are causing a lot of disarray. And also where people are talking about the kinds of relationships within their team that are sort of sustaining them through some hard times and can be kind of life-saving. So I think this is important in either direction.
Yeah, I would agree. I think that the place where it starts is who you choose to work with. So if this is a co-founder you've chosen, if this is employee number one, if this is employee number 10, hiring the right people, I believe, like pretty firmly based on personal experience, is a huge chunk of this. I don't know if I'll say it's 70 or 80%, but I think it might be. I mean, I think if you get the right people around you, people who you work well with, people who are smart and driven, but humble and are willing to work with your work style and you're willing to work with theirs, it's so much easier. You know, you don't have to work around like misunderstandings, miscommunications are just going to happen so much less frequently if you start by getting the right people on the bus is the expression that's commonly used.
I mean, I realize that this is a giant question and there are many, many books written on this subject, but from your real quick version of this answer, like, how do you do that? Like, what do you look for when you're deciding whether someone is going to be the right person for your team or not?
Number one, I'm extremely picky. So I take a long time to hire. And this is something when I've worked for fast growing startups that they didn't like it. They wanted me to just pick somebody, you know, if they were technically capable. And oftentimes that's not going to be the perfect fit. And that's one of the reasons that, you know, Drip grew in terms of headcount slower than it otherwise could have. We had money to hire more people, like in 2015, but we couldn't find, it took us 5 months maybe to find the right senior Rails developer, because the technical skill is 30-40% of the job, and how they work with you is the rest of it. So we do a lot of conversations. We definitely do technical evaluation with a developer or with someone in support, but I would also have a lot of conversations and ask them, you know, how do you take criticism? What do you not like about your current job? Trying to get people, certain people who are like overly negative, I'll say, or who tend to dwell on the negative, or who tend to kind of blame those around them. Even if it's a real, real subtle undertone, you can just detect there's negativity, and you can detect that they think that they're right about things. They're never going to come out and say that in an interview, but I'm trying to pull that out of them. Like, you know, what did you not like about your previous work experience, your coworkers, your boss? And certain people are just like, you know what? I wasn't a good fit. Like, they take it on themselves. Literally, I've heard people say that, you know, I left that company because it wasn't a good fit for me or whatever. But then other people will say, I left that company because they were kind of a bunch of idiots there. And it's like, well, that's a bit of a red flag.
Yeah, it really communicates a level of arrogance that may make it very difficult to work well with someone on a team. And like you've mentioned already, this sort of negligence to take responsibility for one's own role in whatever conflict or whatever group dynamic existed. I'm right there with you. When I was interviewing and hiring folks to work at the clinic that I worked at in Fresno, I wanted people who were humble and who were trustworthy, probably above anything else. And, you know, folks who were really team players and not someone who's there to sort of show off and showboat and be the smartest person in the room. That dynamic of smartest person in the room is, in my opinion, just a really terrible dynamic for any kind of collaboration, or in the case of, you know, a therapy practice, any kind of emotional vulnerability that's necessary to have good supervision.
Yep. And I've talked a lot about the problem-solving approach we used at Drip, and a lot of it is all of us throwing out ideas and just trying to find the best one and not caring about who came up with it. To get to that kind of culture, you have to hire the right people. I mean, there's no level of education or training that you can give people that's going to make them do that if they don't do it naturally.
So let's say you find these great people and they are team players and they have great ideas and they can contribute and collaborate well without needing to take all the glory points. What do you do as someone who is managing or leading your team to create relationships that are healthy in an ongoing, sustainable way?
So, you know, that's another big question. Obviously, it's kind of like, how do you manage, which could be a, you know, an entire book or whatever. But I think there's this really interesting balance between informality and hierarchy, in the sense of, I've seen people swing too far in either direction. You know, I think on a factory floor, there's a lot of hierarchy. In construction crews, there's a lot of hierarchy. And there's typically somebody who's kind of aggressive, who's kind of driving things, and everybody hates their boss. And it's, you know, it's the prototypical kind of job that nobody likes. And that can certainly be in an office environment as well. If you swing all the way the other end, I've seen jobs where it's too informal and the managers want to be friends with kind of the team. And I think that can work in some instances, but I think you have to be really careful. I think it's easy to lose the who's responsible is what it comes down to in my mind. You know, it's like, if you're the founder, that's fine. You can have drinks with your team. I'm not saying you shouldn't do that. But at the end of the day, like, you as the founder are responsible for the ship, and you have to make the decisions. You have to try to get everyone's input. You want to get to the best decision that you can. But ultimately, it's you or you and your co-founder who have to make that decision. And I think that not having that type of, there's just a tiny, tiny bit of authority that I think needs to be maintained, that I think informality can sometimes blur the lines.
I think that's also really good for team members or for employees or contractors too. And I think sometimes we think about this as something that's protective to the leader, but I think it works both ways. That when there are clear roles and it's clear, like, who's in charge and whose responsibility it is to take care of health insurance and whose responsibility it is to make decisions that other people can implement, that also helps everyone else feel safe and clear and like they're able to do their jobs without this kind of enmeshment of friendship and, I don't know, like all the relationship complexity that comes when it's unclear who's leading.
Right. I would agree with that.
And I think there can be lots of warmth and playfulness, and you can have a great time with your team and still maintain a level of separateness that's good for them and for you.
Another thing that I think is extremely important, and this is something that part of who I am, but it's about loyalty. I think that as a manager, you need to always have everyone's back, like everyone on your team's back. Examples of this are customers who get abusive or who, you know, are really a pain in the butt. Like, you need to be willing to fire that customer, and you're going to take heat for it, and they're going to come and get you on social media, and they're going to troll you on blah, blah, blah. But you cannot let customers abuse your people. If you work at a larger company and you have a team and there are other managers that are doing, you know, abuse may be a strong word, but that are whatever, misusing your people's time or schedule, I think that's a big deal. I think being involved when you feel like people on your team are in some kind of peril, I think communicating that up front and not telling people I have your back, but showing them that you have their back. And if they're going on a scary sales call, like, you know, showing up with them or letting them know they can cancel it or letting, you know, there's just this freedom of that you're going to support them in what they do. We've also seen examples where somebody makes a mistake and forgets to turn on an email course, or they put a bug into the code that brings the site down or something. And to me, this is another example of, I've seen managers who do not have your back and they throw you under the bus. And it's this feeling of like a punitive work culture. And I see it as the opposite. Like, if we make a mistake, we tend to say, what happened here? Why did it happen? Can we fix it in the future? Let's all learn from it. And that's genuinely been like my attitude about it. And I think it comes off with the team. I think that if you don't have that, people are scared to make mistakes and they're going to move slow. And at one point early on, Derek broke the site. And I said, look, we're moving fast and we're breaking things, right? It's this quote from Mark Zuckerberg. I mean, this is 2-3 years ago. It's like, if we're moving as fast as we are going to break things sometimes. So shake it off. I know it sucks. So we both feel bad about it, but I'm now going to get on and I'm going to email, you know, hand email all 30 of our customers, which is what I did at the time. And I explained to them what had happened, why there was a, you know, an email delay and blah, blah, blah. And so it showed that I had his back, and B, I was going to do kind of the part of the dirty work in essence, right? He had to fix it, but I had to go in and then fix it with our customers. And I think that kind of show of loyalty is something that I think is a way to manage well.
It just alleviates a lot of anxiety when people aren't afraid to make mistakes, when people aren't afraid that they're going to get blamed for, you know, being uncertain or unsure, that they have the freedom to ask for help. They have the freedom to say right away, oh my gosh, hey, I did this, it went badly, help me out. In the kind of cultures that I've seen where that isn't allowed, there's so much anxiety and, like you said, sort of fear of action that makes you move more slowly, but also degrades any sense of trust and, you know, the sense in which you as a team are in it together. You're all working toward a common goal. And I think that's what makes a great team, is that you're all motivated, you're all driven, and you have a clear sense of the goal in front of you, and everybody's contributing their piece to get that done.
Yeah, that's right.
And certainly the loyalty, the sense in which you as a leader are ultimately sort of the servant of everyone else, saying, I've got your back, I will fix it for you, I will make it possible for you to do your job in any way that I can, then that really pushes that kind of healthy culture forward.
That's right. And I think you could, you know, the danger is you could swing too far the other way. Imagine if somebody crashed the site and you came in and you're like, hey, no, this is no big deal, no problem. But it is a big deal and it is a problem. And I think you need to find that balance, right? Of don't minimize it, because then people, they don't believe you. Like, you can't say things that just aren't true. Just because you say them doesn't make them true, right? So there's a balance between minimizing it on one side and then penalizing people on the other side and being in the middle somewhere and being like, hey, okay, yeah, this is a big deal, let's get it fixed. And then just matter of fact, you know, let's look at this and let's all learn from this. And is there a way that we can fix this and shake it off?
I remember kind of early on in my life as a supervisor, I gave pretty clear instructions to two of the people that were working under me. And, you know, between the two of them, they miscommunicated and they botched it and blah, blah, blah. And it basically didn't get done. And it was an important thing that had to do with one of our patients' safety. And the next time that I met with them and I checked in about whether they had followed up, they just hadn't done it. They missed it. And I, in that moment, was able to say, look, guys, I'm really angry about this. Like, this is not acceptable. I'm really pissed. And how do we keep this from happening again? And I think I kind of intimidated the hell out of them in that moment, but it was also really important for me to just be really upfront with how I felt so that it was all out on the table. And we did. We had a really good conversation about what went wrong and what needed to be done and put a kind of a different plan in place. They understood that what happened, that the mistake that was made was a really big deal to me. And I guarantee that they won't ever make that mistake again. But yet, like, my affection and commitment to them didn't waver at all, because once we were able to sort of express, hey, this was a major fail on our part, we have to do this better. And I needed to be able to say, look, I'm really angry about this. Like, this is not okay. We're really failing at our work if we're missing these kinds of big safety issues. But it was a good experience for me to, you know, have something negative happen, and everybody recovered just fine because we like each other and we trust each other. And I know that they didn't mean to do something stupid. And so I'm, you know, still as equally committed to them as I was at the beginning.
Yeah, there's a luxury we have building these small teams that you don't have if you're building a team at a large organization. And the luxury we have is that, you know, I like to think that a lot of us, the founders, have decent instincts about people and are fairly reasonable people, and that left to our own devices, assuming that we can, you know, figure out these interpersonal things, that we're going to make pretty good calls in terms of trying to balance this informality and the hierarchy and that kind of stuff. But the nice part is you right there were able to make a decision to do that and to let them know that it was a problem. And there was no one above you like yelling and screaming that made you get all rattled and have to yell and scream at these guys, right? And there was no one, you know, when we've had website outages, like, it is genuinely my concern, but it's not like an external force that is forcing things or an external policy. I ran into this at City of Pasadena that just killed me. I would have a team. I wanted to run it a certain way. I had instincts about how to tell people what to do and what, you know, how to do it. And then these like external, these things were just handed down from like two or three layers above. And they're like, suddenly no one has these days off in the company, or suddenly, I don't know, just these random policies would change. And I was asked to deliver that news, and I was supposed to not tell them that it was bullshit, you know? And that's really hard. And that's again, a luxury we have in these small teams, is that we can define that culture, right? We don't have someone handing down an edict that says you have to terminate for this, or you can't, I don't know, give people this many days off in December, or just whatever. There were just all these crazy policies. I remember that, like, when you have to enforce things that you don't believe in, but you have to sit and act like you do, it really creates a tough, it's kind of a tough place to be in.
It's why both you and I burned out of government work.
Totally.
Sadly.
7 months I lasted at the City of Pasadena.
I lasted a little bit longer, but...
Yep. It was almost purely because of that. I actually liked a lot of the people I worked with, but that kind of stuff killed me. I think wrapping up the topic, you know, we're on kind of on the second or third bullet, and it's like managing well. I think we've kind of already explained why having some hierarchy is good, right? Having a totally flat structure where no one's in charge, I think, could create some chaos, some uncertainty. I think team members actually like to have that. So there's someone to go to ask questions and help, you know, codify some decisions. And I think, you know, hierarchy and then some structure, not a ton of structure, especially for small, in terms of, you know, when I think of structure, I think of like a lot of process, a lot of how you do things, a lot of meetings. You know, I've seen teams of 10 people have 10 hours of meetings a week or something. And it's just like, no, you can't do that and still get work done. But some structure, a little bit of structure, I think is, you know, at this early phase, you need some standards, right? Like, hey, don't slack developers during the day unless it's urgent, or don't slack anyone during the day unless it's urgent. You know, just, I'm kind of making up some stuff, but like, these are certain policies of things that structures we've tried to put in place that help keep the team, you know, running well.
I think that also helps create a culture of professionalism. And again, I'm all for joking around and having a good time and meeting for drinks every now and then. But I think especially in the day in and day out of work, that some expectation of professional conduct is really important in terms of both preserving the sense that everybody feels respected and that you can have some diversity in a team, and there's a level of interacting with each other or a level of structure that protects everybody from either being hurt and having these like time-wasting personnel issues, and protects people from their time being wasted by not having these sort of structures in place that protect people from like endless numbers of sarcastic slacks being passed around all day.
Right. And if you're hiring the right people, they hate having their time wasted. Like, the right people, again, right is like in quotes, as we said earlier, like, you're getting the right people on the bus. they're motivated to get their work done. You know, they want to ship. They get the dopamine rush from shipping a feature if they're a developer, or maybe shipping a blog post if they're your marketer, or shipping a new ad campaign. I mean, it's just the distractions can be fun for a minute or two. And then I have found that the best teams I work on really are heads down most of the time, even when no one's looking, you know, and that if someone's in there joking or kind of wasting time, it kind of irritates you. It's like, I have work to do. Why aren't you working?
And it strikes me that you're kind of talking about, at least in the psychological literature, we talk about intrinsic versus extrinsic motivation. I mean, there's some people that show up to work because they are motivated to get things done and they don't want their time wasted, and they're built that way. It's intrinsic. And then there are other folks who are sort of more externally motivated by, I don't know, like trinkets and rewards and stickers on a star chart.
Carrots and sticks.
Yes, yes. Carrots and sticks. How do you think about cultivating intrinsic motivation, which I realize is sort of a dumb question because intrinsic is intrinsic. It's not cultivated, but you are doing something to preserve it or protect it, I guess, in somebody who's managing well. So assuming you have the right people and they all show up ready to work and they're intrinsically motivated, how do you keep that flowing well in the course of a workday?
Yep. This is a really good question. So the first thing is, yeah, you have to find people that are intrinsically motivated. And this is another big piece that I try to screen for when I've been hiring for the past 15 years, frankly, you know, is are they going to be intrinsically motivated? And then once you have them, then you need to let them run wild. Like I used to say in our job description, we like hiring really smart people and then getting out of their way. And that's how I feel about it, is you have to remove the obstacles from them getting their gig done, you know? And so if you hire a developer, I try to remove distractions. I try to buy them the best computer that we can possibly afford, with two 24-inch monitors, which is what, you know, everybody on my team has. I mean, these are all things that it just makes your work life that much easier, or that much better. I try to protect them from distractions and interruptions, and allow them to ship code as soon as they can. I will also just ask people straight up, like, do you need more challenging work? And, you know, a recent hire that started with us in the past month or two, it's fantastic. He came up to me a week or two in and he's like, you know, who has the login to the knowledge base? And I said, I can get you one. What do you need? And he said, I found an error. Who should fix it? And I was like, well, do you want to? And he was like, absolutely. And it was like, he was coming to me because he wanted to make something right. And he was a little bit tentative. He didn't want to like overstep bounds. He thought somebody owned the knowledge base, right? And that he was going to be overstepping. But it's like, no, you go do this. And then after 2 or 3 weeks, he said, can you just start having all new, you know, developer tickets assigned to me? And like, he was coming to me to tell me that. And that tells me he's intrinsically motivated. And I keep asking him, how can we get out of your way? How can we get, you know, what else do you need? And he's like, I'd love a task like this. I'd love it. Like, he's out there asking. And maybe that's not everyone, right? Everyone doesn't necessarily come to you and ask for these things, but really is like clearing out any roadblocks that could potentially get in the way of basically what they should be doing on a day-to-day basis. You know, you might hear it referred to as like a zone of genius. I just think of it as like the thing that they really, that person really wants to do and is really good at. How can you try to remove everything else from their plate? Another thing with intrinsic and extrinsic motivation, you know, I listened to, there's an audiobook, and it's a takedown piece of HubSpot, unfortunately. And of course, I like Dharmesh. He's a colleague of mine who's the co-founder of HubSpot. The book is called Disrupted, and it's about a guy in his 50s who winds up going to work for HubSpot, and there's a bunch of young people working there, and he doesn't like the company culture. So I, to be honest, a lot of the stuff he says I disagree with in the book. But one thing he points out was like how much hype there was and how he felt like people were being extrinsically motivated by, like you said, kind of sticker chart type stuff. And it was really poignant, you know, the comments he made and the kind of the rallies that they would have to try to get everybody hyped up about things. And I think you need to think about this. Like, you know, are you hiring intrinsically motivated people that want to get stuff done? Or are you having to, you know, carrot and stick them with carrots and sticks?
carrots and sticks.
Allow myself to introduce my
I guess, to what extent are you eliciting an eye roll in your teammates? But I, you know, I'm like old and cynical, so I just want to do my work, and I don't need any extra bells and whistles. I want to be paid well, and I don't want any drama. And anything beyond that, I tend to just sort of roll my eyes and like feel like the sort of rebellious kid sitting in the back of the high school pep rally, thinking, "Wow, this is crap."
Nice. Two bleeps in this one. And I think part of that is knowing your demographic and your generation, right? It's like, well, who's working for you? Are you working with folks who you have an idea of what motivates them? Then do that. But if you don't, and you just kind of have to say things to motivate people, that's a tougher job. I'm not sure that I know how to motivate extrinsically motivated people very well. And I would recommend for most people starting software companies, probably not the route you want to go.
Yeah. And that's also not who you are. Like back in the day, in the recesses of your history, like you were a code monkey. And the best thing of, is that an offensive term?
No. That's cool.
Okay. The best sort of moment of your life is hitting render or go or whatever you hit and watching all the pieces fall into place and it works magically. And well, magically from my perspective, but you're not, at least historically, like not a sales guy and not someone who is going after, you know, a bonus or a, I don't know, like the thing about you is that you love seeing it work, not that you need this. I don't want to use the word external again, but not that you need like a sparkly, shiny prize that is different than the innate satisfaction of seeing your process work well.
Yeah, the sparkly, shiny prize is the feature going live. That's the motivation. And that's a good point. That is a bias of mine, right? That's who I am. And that tends to be the people who I've hired. I feel like our drip team is filled, you know, including Derek and the rest of the team is just filled with people like that. So maybe if you are more of an externally motivated person that this, you know, might not, maybe you're going to build a team with a different structure.
I think one of the challenges is really having a good handle on the differences that are present within your team, the different personalities, the different motivations or motivators. And then also, you know, creating a team that still works fast and streamlined, but has some space for diverse voices or diverse experiences.
Yeah. It's funny, the argument of like homogeneous versus diverse teams. I know there's been studies about how diversity can lend more opinions and it can long-term lead to like better outcomes. And I'm not sure how they define those. You know, I think that having diverse opinions and diverse folks on your team is something that's going to be a benefit. I've always kind of strived for homogeneity in terms of motivation and work ethic, right? And intrinsic motivation. And when I look at teams that I've built or been a part of, those are the people that I have the like the deepest working relationships with, are the people that want to get things done and are really kind of happy to be on board. And I guess, you know, respond to everything we've said here, like to a very, very light hierarchy, to light structure, to having someone like build the loyalty of a manager and who pays that back with doing their best work.
Well, those are the essential qualities. And that's where you have to have homogeneity. Like that's where you have to have shared values that you don't have to explain to everyone. Everybody's on board. But in terms of like cultural differences and differences in experiences, that can deepen a team, but primarily people all have to be kind of motivated and have the same work value.
Right. At least those are the teams that I've seen work best. And I've worked on, I know, I'm trying to think, maybe a dozen teams, give or take, maybe more than that over the past 15 years, because I was on consulting teams that would switch up now and again. And I mean, I've had really good working relationships with folks who, you know, look and act just like me. And I've had really good working relationships with people who look totally different and, you know, and act very different from me in terms of, like you said, you know, culture or race or gender or any of these things. But the key factor that linked us is it was like excellence, right? It was this desire, this intrinsic desire to ship things, to be motivated and to do good work. And that's the right people. You know, those are the right people. That's what you're looking for. And if you can get them on board and then treat them well, like I think those are the two kickers.
And that's the job of the team captain, is not getting in the way, letting everybody do their good work, be excellent, and protecting everyone's personal integrity, making sure everyone feels respected, making sure everyone feels trusted, and nobody feels anxious or overly worried that they won't be supported. But for everyone to know that they're supported, that you have their back, and that they can just go and do their work.
Yep. And you could call it building a company culture, you could call it team culture, you can call it just, you know, kind of the work style of your team, but whatever you call it, I mean, these are the nuts and bolts of building, like, to me, what is a highly efficient, highly effective group of people who work together and respect one another and turn out a really good product.
I have found it to be a really, like, significant privilege to run a team. Something that I've really have enjoyed that's been a really great learning experience for me. And it's actually something I'm missing a lot now that I'm operating on my own and I'm not working within a larger team and I'm not supervising other people. I think it's something that's a challenge and it's a different set of skills than most technical people innately possess, but something to really give thought and attention to and strive to be good at, both for your own personal sanity and the well-being of your company. But I think it also, you know, it feels good to do well by other people. And it feels good to create an opportunity for people to make a good living doing something that's interesting and meaningful and in a place or in a community of people where they're valued and respected.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Zen Founder. Our theme song is A New Beginning by bensound.com, used under Creative Commons.